Hello, I'm Ross Kamage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. My guest today is someone I've known for several years, and I think really starts to delve into a different aspect of cancer. And I don't want to, you know, steal your thunder, Jamie, but it's about behavioral science. My guest today is Dr. Jamie Stutes. Jamie, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Yeah, thanks, Ross. I'm Jamie Stutes. I'm a clinical health psychologist by training, a behavioral scientist in studies of lung cancer prevention and control activities. I'm fortunate to be a professor here in the Division of Medical Oncology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, and I co-lead the Cancer Prevention and Control Program for the University of Colorado Cancer Center.
So I know where I want to end up with this call, because there's some totally drop the mic moments that Jamie's been involved with. But let's dig into, what on earth is psychology? Is it different from clinical psychology? And how does a fine, upstanding young man decide to go into that as a career?
So my background started with a high school course in psychology that, you know, was just talking about some of the basics. And I was really intrigued by it, by human behavior and animal behavior, and how, you know, reinforcement schedules of mice and pigeons and dogs and rats and, you know, could be changed based on reinforcement, reward, or conditioning principles. And so I went to college thinking that I would get, you know, major in one of the areas of psychology, and that that happened, and I just continued to really enjoy it. But at the end, I wasn't sure I wasn't sure if I wanted to be a researcher or a clinician. So I pursued degrees where I could do both. And that's why I ended up in counseling and clinical health psychology, because I wanted to explore whether I was really a researcher, if I was going to be a clinician, or some of both.
Well, let's go into that in a little bit of detail. So where did you grow up?
So I am an Iowan. I grew up in central Iowa, surrounded by cornfields and lots of animals. But I myself was not did not live on a farm, although I have family members who did in other veins of our family tree. But I grew up in a small community, small manufacturing community in central Iowa that we affectionately called Mudville, but most people call Marshalltown, Iowa. It's a lovely place.
And was it muddy?
Only in the ecology of the it wasn't indeed that money, actually. It just for my friends and I, it just seemed to fit. It was Mudville to us.
And then what did your parents do in this small town?
So my father was in manufacturing and worked as inventory control, and my mother had the most delightful job of being a toy librarian. Literally, she managed a library filled with toys that people in the community could come and check out. And so it served a wide variety of our communities. And, you know, selfishly as a kid, it was incredible, because we got new toys every 3 weeks or so because of our access to the toy library. And of course, they had to go back because it's a library. But so we were constantly infused with new opportunities to new toy things.
Did that affect your attention span?
I think social media has probably harmed that more. But it was kind of perfect timing, because, you know, any toy kind of runs its course after a couple of weeks. And by that time, you were kind of done with it and on to the next. So it was just enriching.
And was there just you, or do you have brothers and sisters?
So I have a brother who's a biochemist and works for a pharmaceutical company in Germany. And my sister is works at University of Wisconsin Medical Center up in Madison.
What does she do there?
She works in administration.
Okay. And are you the oldest of the three?
I am the oldest.
So one of the things, If somebody, you know, there's this old joke about, you know, people who go into psychiatry are inherently crazy. So are people who go into psychology, Is that because you were really good at human behavior, or you were looking for some clues because you were struggling? I mean, why psychology? I mean, why? I think you told me you were a gold star introvert at one point.
Yes, I'm absolutely that. And my common answer that's probably inappropriate, but I'm going to say it anyways, because I went into psychology because I really don't like people. But that's not really true. I was more intrigued by the science side of it and impacting human behavior and how to impact performance. And so I was an athlete as a kid and actually swam competitively through college. And my first love was actually sports psychology and using some of the behavioral principles that we'd learned to actually improve performance. I guess you'd call it performance enhancing psychology as opposed to performance enhancing biology. So that was an interest of mine and one of the things I thought I would pursue in terms of my graduate training.
Was there an element of personal interest? I mean, because I think you were captain of the swim team in this little Iowa college.
Yes.
And did you try and jazz up your teammates to enhance their performance? Were you an armchair psychologist even then?
I was in some ways. So I was always, a swim meet is typically long and, but I was always invested in my other teammates' swims and, you know, competing as a team. So I really like that. But personally, I really delved into imagery and performance enhancing imagery and able to, you know, to mentally practice my events and to take a really strategic approach to how I would swim, because I'm not Michael Phelps, you know, I have none of the physical stature or characteristics. And so I think I had to compensate by working hard and using what was between my ears to improve my performance. And so that's really what was in it for me and what was intriguing.
And then I have to ask, so what was your stroke?
Okay. So I was actually I started out as primarily a breaststroker and then added butterfly. But I also competed in the individual medley, which is swimming everything, except I was a perfectly atrocious backstroker. So it was always quite humorous. If you ever watch the individual medley, there's so much more change in who's leading and falling behind because people have various strengths and challenges. And so I would typically have a little bit of a lead to start and then fall back and then catch up on breaststroke and sometimes take the lead and then hold on for dear life on my freestyle, which is, you know, my third best stroke.
Wow. And so that was all in Lawrence College, which is somewhere in Iowa.
Yeah, it's in Dubuque, Iowa. It's on the border of Illinois and in Wisconsin, and it's a lovely place on the hills over looking the Mississippi River.
And so at the end of that, you've decided, I think you majored in psychology, and then it's time for graduate studies, and then this is where your move to the Southeast really began. And, yeah. You know, why? I mean, it's a long way from Iowa, Kentucky.
Because I got in was the primary thing. We don't talk about it a lot, but it's getting into graduate programs in psychology is not quite as hard as getting into medical school, but pretty darn close. And so I got in and started my career there. But the real reason that Kentucky was one of my top priorities was because they had both research and they had the counseling program, so I could explore whether I wanted to be a clinician or not. But they also had some expertise in sports psychology. In particular, there was a faculty member that was pretty well known for his contributions to sports psychology. And I thought, you know, this is a great place where I could get everything that I was looking for.
And then when did you stay sitting on the fence? You know, are you going to be a clinical psychologist? I, you know, seeing patients, clients, whatever you call them, and dealing with their psychological issues versus research? When did you decide which way you were going to go? Because you're kind of backing your horse both ways. If that's a Kentucky joke, by the way.
So yes, I was on the fence with that question. And in psychology, we have a training model that's pretty longstanding that was actually credited to a meeting in the 50s, I believe, that actually occurred in Boulder, Colorado. And it's called the Boulder model, but we also call it the scientist practitioner model. And so if you're going to go into applied psychology, we get training in both science and practice. And so we don't often split, and it's very akin to, Dr. Zerhuni's initiative around clinician scientists and training in the clinical and translational science initiatives that started in the 2000s. But psychology had been doing some of that since the 50s and 60s.
Well, that just sounds like a recipe to stay on the fence, but...
It is. It's actually a recipe to stay on the fence for your entire career, because the idea is that you're doing some of both, that your clinical work is feeding into your science and your science is improving your clinical work. And I believe in that, but I also know that it's really hard. And so I started in graduate school to clarify that the days when I went in and would have a clinical practice day, I would approach that day in the morning very excited to learn and to hone my skills. And at the end of the day, I was wiped out, completely exhausted, couldn't possibly do anything more. But on my research days, I would go in to the office, spend the whole day coding data, analyzing data, doing what I wanted to be doing there. And at the end of the day, I didn't want to leave. I wanted to stay. I'd go home and code more data and program more surveys and do more things. And so as a behavioral scientist, Jamie, it's kind of telling as to what you're really interested in. And so that's where I started to recognize that I really wanted to delve into getting the experimental training and the scientific training to be a scientist first and a practitioner kind of second.
Well, some of that is also, to use terms that obviously I don't know as well as you, but aren't introverts just sort of drained by social interaction? I certainly am. I do a clinic and I go home and I can't string two words together.
Yes. Which is so pleasant for our families, but yeah, that's it too. So there's definitely some of that as an introvert that the energy that goes into a consultation session or a counseling session or even an assessment when we're doing that is more taxing to me than being a computer jockey and hammering away a manuscript or a poster or preparing a PowerPoint slide.
Yeah, so I did the back of the envelope calculation. You spent something like nearly 10 years in training, which is embarrassing. I thought mine was long, and that's about as long as mine was.
Well, other people tend to be a little bit more efficient in that space. I really like school, so I just stick around. But I started out in a track in counseling psychology, which is a little bit more focused on applied perspectives. And then as I was sitting for my qualifying exams in counseling psych, I just felt like I really want to do research and I really want to be a clinical psychologist. And the vast majority of the world doesn't care about the differences between those, and nor should they. But for me, it was relevant. And so I actually started over for the most part. I have enough graduate credits for two PhDs based on that experience. And so there are folks that questioned the sanity of that decision to this day, still question the sanity of the decision, but it worked out for me. And I was able to spend more of my training time developing the scientific training that I wanted in statistics and research methodologies and take extra credits in those spaces to get to where I wanted to be as a clinical psychologist. And that's also when the opportunities in health psychology started to emerge for me and really clarify what my path might look like in terms of my career.
So flesh that one out, because one of the questions is, like, you do all this training and then you pop out at the end in 2001 before your faculty appointment. And, you know, what are you? What are you an expert in?
Yeah. Well, you know, the whole imposter syndrome would say that I was an expert in nothing, which definitely was felt. But I went into graduate school thinking of, you know, doing some counseling and being working in sports psychology. But the thing I didn't mention before is that when I arrived in Kentucky, one of the first things I did was to, you know, orient myself and check out some of the places. And I wanted to go walk by the campus office of the sports psychologist and kind of pop in before classes started to see. And there was a note on the door that said, "I've taken early retirement. Don't call, don't email." It actually didn't say that. It just said, "I'm taking early retirement, best wishes." And I'm going, well, bummer.
Yeah. You just read the subtext that said, you know, "Dear Mr. Stutz, you know, show, go whatever yourself."
Yes, exactly. You're so much for your career in sports psychology. And so, but I wasn't too bothered by that. They still had a couple classes that I was able to take, and it wasn't like it was going to be my major degree or anything. It was just something that was, I wanted to be part of my career at that time. So I then had a colleague who said, "Jamie, why don't you take this health psychology class with me? It's a graduate course in health psychology." And I said, "You know, I don't really have room in my schedule for it." And she said, "Oh, come on, it's the closest thing you're going to get to sports psychology, you know." And I said, "Okay, I'll do it." And it was fantastic. It was like every new week, in introduction to a new area of how psychology impacts cardiovascular health, how psychology impacts substance abuse and substance use, how does psychology impact or can support transplant, you know, solid organ and then stem cell transplant kind of things. And then the oncology days came, and that's where I really got interested. And same way with pain and pain management. And, you know, this is a period of time in the 90s before we had some of the more innovative pharmacologic approaches to supportive care and pain management. And there was interest a lot in that time in multidisciplinary management of pain, pain strategies, and helping people cope. So those are my two areas, ended up being pain management as well as oncology. Now, the pain management, I had clinical opportunities at the University of Kentucky for training, but they really didn't have training in psychosocial oncology. And so most of my work in that space was in research. And I was very fortunate to have an outstanding mentor, Mike Andrikowski, who had done some really pioneering work on a number of aspects of oncology related to anticipatory nausea and vomiting, as well as quality of life during early stem cell transplants, the cognitive effects. He was actually one of the first folks that started to think about the cognitive or neurocognitive effects of chemotherapies in the time when the prevailing sentiment was that, you know, chemotherapies don't cross the blood-brain barrier, so how could there possibly be any neurocognitive effects of these treatments? And we know now that there definitely are, that chemo brain is real and there are reasons for it. But he kind of pioneered that. And he also, another pioneering area he had is to stop thinking about cancer as universally a negative event, that some people do experience personal growth following the diagnosis, and not in a platitude sort of way, but in a way that this is certainly an event that it has stressful elements, but can have life organizing elements as well and life benefiting elements as well. And so he was largely responsible for stimulating that area of recognition of cancer as not just a universally negative event, but a life-changing event.
Yeah, I have one of my patients actually started a kind of self-help podcast and has a sort of side career as a life coach. And one of the things she says to newly diagnosed patients, she's a stage 4 survivor herself, is at some point, you know, maybe not today, maybe not next month or next year, you are going to be thankful for your diagnosis. And they're like, no. And then, you know, that epiphany day comes. And yeah, I've also had other patients say that cancer was the best thing that ever happened to them, which sounds so perverse looking from the outside. But if people have chaos in their life or lack of focus, it is the wake up call for some people.
Absolutely, it is. It changes relationships. It changes priorities. You know, you hear people that get so wrapped up in their careers that they kind of drop off from the social scene and their family scene or doing things. And this is an opportunity to correct some of those things in their life that they see as deficiencies and make changes. Yeah, it's not everyone, though. It comes back to the psychology of it in terms of how we perceive it.
Well, one of the things we're slightly getting off topic is, at least in the field of some cancers, even though you're still incurable, as we have lengthened the time that people can live with their diagnosis, it does allow people time to get their head around it. It was very hard where, you know, you're just diagnosed with something and, you know, some of the worst cancers only had a prognosis of a few weeks when I was first starting, and they would be debilitating during that period of time. And, you know, how do you get your head around the bit when you are literally, the plane is going down and it's on fire? I mean, it's difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where it becomes hard in reality, because we don't necessarily want to be pushing positive psychology on people when that's happening. But we want to remain open and receptive to it and supportive of it when folks are experiencing themselves and maybe have that blossom and help them as they navigate. I've always struggled with interventions that are specifically designed to find that post-traumatic growth.
Yeah. 'Cause
it feels forced. And there's something about this that in some ways that seems like some of the real garbage out there before about you have to stay positive. You have to be positive about your cancer diagnosis, and somehow that's going to protect you and benefit you. And that's garbage, because there's nothing about a cancer diagnosis that inherently constrains your life to only experiencing a subset of emotions, and they all must be positive. That's not real. The cancer sucks, and that's real. And so trying to be all positive in that sense isn't necessarily very helpful or adaptive and coping-wise for most folks. But there is a balance between, you know, being receptive, and I think it does age easier, if you will, to find some of those things if you have the opportunity for longer-term survivorship.
Okay, so let's move into, so like 2001, you start as an instructor in the Department of Medicine in, not University of Kentucky, but University of Louisville. So still in Kentucky.
Yeah. So I'd finished up my residency and my internship at Duke University and escaped North Carolina back to Kentucky and had the first opportunity at the University of Louisville James Grant Brown Cancer Center, where I was working as a scientist practitioner. I was able to develop a small clinic there to provide psychosocial or behavioral oncology interventions to individuals and families facing cancer. But my primary responsibility was research, and I started continued my career at that time, where my training had been basically in breast and ovarian cancer. I did some work on ovarian cancer screening, as well as behavioral aspects and responses to a breast cancer diagnosis. And at that time, a lot of the research was on breast cancer for a variety of reasons. You had a very strong advocacy community that was pushing for funding for survivorship care that went beyond treatment and addressing some of the other factors. And as well as the time during the mid-90s when genetic factors were being more identified, BRCA1, BRCA2, and looking at, you know, genetic counseling and genetic education and thinking about how those decisions would affect individuals and families with regard to prophylactic treatments or things. And that was all very interesting to me. And my mentor had sort of, he had a number of mentees that we were covered on fellowships. And one of the things that he did is sort of carve out, okay, this is going to be your area of expertise. You know, it's not like he forced us into them, but he sort of helped us carve those out. And everybody had a little bit different area of expertise. And I was the guy slotted in to study breast and ovarian cancer and some of the genetic and familial links that were being recognized during that time. And so those are the things that I was carrying over into my early career at the University of Louisville, which I continue to reflect on very fondly about the time and growth opportunities there. And that's where I first started to get introduced to some of the opportunities in lung cancer. In studying aspects of lung cancer, because of some personal family history, I never thought that I would be a lung cancer researcher. My grandmother grew up or instilled in me a not a very positive attitude towards smoking, because it took the life of her husband and my grandfather at a very early age, and so she was a pretty aggressive anti-smoking person, and I felt like I had too many biases to potentially be a good scientist in that space. But the opportunities kept presenting themselves, and one of those opportunities was related to the Jewish Hospital Lung Cancer Screening Study, which was actually a randomized trial of low-dose CT that predated the National Lung Screening Trial. It was, of course, a small trial, a single institution, but I was able to secure some grant funding to add on some behavioral measures to look at cognitive and affective and behavioral responses to lung cancer screening. And this was, of course, in the early 2000s, when before it was an evidence-based practice. And I found it very enriching, and I started to learn. And I was working clinically in the multidisciplinary head and neck clinic, which is, you know, very closely related to our lung cancer community of individuals, and starting to build out a whole lot better sense of empathy for the community and understanding of smoking and tobacco use in that community, and approaches to be more effective in helping them during a very distressing time. Change a behavior that has been a pillar and support strategy for them for many years in most cases. And it was a lot of time with the community that taught me how to be a better psychologist for individuals facing a tobacco-related malignancy.
Well, there's always that line that you can only really dislike people you don't know. And I think once you get to know almost anybody, you see, you know, the positives and the humanity in it. And certainly that there isn't a group of people that I would like to say I dislike, and if I did, it would be because I haven't met them yet. So by immersing yourself in the smoking community, and I guess it is a community, I guess you learned that.
Absolutely. And they're learning their stories and their perspectives, and you know how they started, and you know, learning that empathy was a lot more important than any of the psychology tricks and tactics I had in my skill set, even though, you know, I was fresh out of my training and a new licensed clinical health psychologist, really proud about that, really happy with that, that it was the other things that were actually most impactful when I could sit down with the 70-year-old lawyer in Eastern Kentucky and talk about his life and how smoking had played a role in it, and some of the regret that he had. And there's very few situations where you would expect a 70-year-old male lawyer from Eastern Kentucky to engage in counseling. Yet we were able to bridge some of those, that stigma and that bias, to have some pretty productive discussions that I really hope had as much benefit for him as it did for me in terms of learning to be a better clinician and better professional.
I can't remember if I told you this, but one of the nurse practitioners we have in the clinic cannot give up smoking. She doesn't smoke a lot, but she'll still come in with, you know, you can smell the cigarettes on her. And you know, she was very worried that, you know, you couldn't function as a nurse practitioner in a lung cancer clinic and we'd all be terribly judgmental. But, you know, as long as she's not reeking of cigarettes, then I actually think she adds value. She adds something that a smoker who happens to be a patient can say, look, you know, I identify with you and your struggles, and we get it. It's not, it's almost, there's a lot of similarities between smoking and weight loss, I suspect. And having, you know, collaborated with some of the colleagues in the weight loss clinic here, the whole idea of medicine as judgmental and, you know, why don't you just, you know, lose weight? Why don't you just exercise? Why don't you just quit smoking? Seems to me to be a stunningly ineffective approach.
It's absolutely ineffective. Some of the stigmas and biases that we've developed around smoking and weight, for that matter, actually do more harm than benefit with regard to our clinical care that we provide. And I joke that most of our clinical care around tobacco and smoking is volume based. And I'm not talking about volume in terms of numbers. I'm talking about our voice volume. You know, the first time you introduce the possibility of smoking with someone who you're working with, it's like, you know, Ross, it might be a good idea for you to, you know, quit smoking. It would really improve your health and your outcomes, and treatment will be easier on you and things like that. And they say, oh, that's probably a good idea. Let me give it a shot, or maybe not for me now, but whatever it is. And then, you know, a couple months later and there's been no progress and whatever. And it's like, no, I really need to sit you down and talk about this. And the only thing that really changes is the volume of your voice until the third or fourth meeting, when it says, you know, it's like, damn it, Ross, you are messing with the potential to be better here. And, you know, none of that communicates the empathy and connection that we need, or an understanding, because the vast majority of folks who work on tobacco, just like you highlighted, haven't been regular tobacco users, have not been addicted to nicotine and smoking. And some of that distance between the clinician and patient, you know, shows up in that lack of empathy and ability to help them make things, because there's nothing we can do to make them quit. And one of my least favorite words is get. I need to get my patient to quit smoking. I need to get my, because there's some power that we have over them and can manipulate them into doing something that we value that they may or may not. And until the individual says, I want to quit smoking, and they come to that, so it's done for them, and they recognize that they are the folks that are, you know, we are not going to experience any of the consequences of their persistent smoking. None of the health consequences impact the clinician. They all impact the individual and their families and their networks. And so we have to understand some of that social context and help build their motivation and support them through the process. But maybe we're getting a little bit off track. But
we are. But on that off track, let me throw out something which I think is true. You can correct me if it's wrong. But the USA is one of the few countries that the warning labels on cigarettes does not say this is addictive. Is that true?
I am not an expert on the warning label things. I actually don't love the warning labels strategy. I think we can communicate messages in there, but fear and messages based on those with graphic images of things that are used in Europe, yes, they've been shown to help a little bit, but that's because we weren't talking about the potential negative side effects as well. The analogy that I use is, when was the last time that a new chemotherapy was permitted to be on the market when we didn't have an understanding, a basic understanding of the side effect profile?
Yeah. I would say never.
Never.
Yeah.
But yet some of these behavioral interventions that we get so enamored with the potential benefits that we forget that any kind of manipulation, any intervention has both a benefit and a potential harm. It could be cost. It could be personal, you know, psychological harm. It could be physical harm. It could be opportunity cost, you know, what we're doing instead. And in this case, those very aggressive tobacco control messages that we've been using, and messages and imagery since the Surgeon General's report in 1964, we didn't have stigma, lung cancer stigma, until we started to really get aggressive about our tobacco control. And those messages did not differentiate between the act of smoking and the marketing to support smoking and the individual who had been impacted by that, perhaps manipulated by it into smoking, and that person as an individual, in separating the empathy we have or would hope to have for any individual, much like you were alluding to earlier, you know, anybody that you don't know, that you don't think you like, is just that you haven't met them yet or gotten to know them. And that's kind of how we lump individuals with a smoking history. We think of them as flawed because they can't quit. We think of them as intellectually challenged because any smart person would have quit a long time ago after all the accumulated evidence. And we heap that on them in our interactions with them. And that didn't happen until we had aggressive tobacco control. And yet this filters through how we interact with this community on many different levels.
Isn't it interesting that I wonder if a lot of the smoking cessation messaging is really a mirror? It's sort of directed against the person giving the message, going, look, what a great job I'm doing. I'm telling you, you're bad.
Oh, my goodness. That's so much what it is. That's how I interpret it. And that extends to some of the work in lung cancer screening. You know, those folks of us who've been studying this for a very long time are so excited about this opportunity, but we fail to put ourselves in the shoes of the people that we're trying to serve with it. And so we put up big pictures of CT scanners. Now, you know, you and I can't live our lives and do our work without CT scanners. They're very important. They're a cool technology that allows us inside views of the person's body to see a tumor that's shrinking, to see a tumor that's growing, to see these other things or these nodules that might be lung cancer or might not be. So it's a vital tool. But if we put that on a billboard for individuals who are eligible for lung cancer screening, what do they see when they see that image? They see expensive. They see costly. They may even be anxious and fearful of knowing that they might have lung cancer if they're at high risk. And we know, one of the things we know about our community is that they're economically a bit more on the vulnerable side. And so if we're sending images of cost and expense, and that's how they're being interpreted, they don't see the cool technology part. They see cost. And yet lung cancer screening for the vast majority of eligible Americans is absolutely free.
Wow.
So this is our fundamental failure to get out of our perspective and into their perspective, because our perspective doesn't matter at all. This is a behavior. This is a choice that individuals are making. And if we're mis-messaging, whether it's a condescending, paternalistic message that you should do this, or costly messages or images of burning lungs. And, you know, that's not an appealing message for an individual who knows and lives with a sense and lives with a belief that they are going to get lung cancer and that's how they're going to die, because that's what our public health messaging has shared with us. There's no empathy there. There's no compassion there. There's no real motivation to improve your health if you're struggling to quit smoking. So it's just more complicated. And I guess the reason I got on this tangent is the difference between with medical interventions, whether it's a drug or a device, we have to fully understand the benefits and the harms. Where in some areas of behavioral science, we've only focused on the benefits and no consideration of the harms, whether they be at the individual or societal level. And this is where our aggressive tobacco control messaging has harms. And I tongue-in-cheek often say that our tobacco control messages are addicted to fear and stigma. And that's like the only way we can do this. We don't infuse positive messages or supportive messages or empathy. And the old TIPS campaign and the new TIPS campaign, it used to be
TIPS stands for
it's TIPS for individuals. Well, It's called tips for former smokers, but I don't use that terminology. We use person first language in most kids' situations to try to, to say the individual first who happens to smoke. But anyway, tips campaign is a strategy of a solitary individual who's experienced a consequence of a tobacco-related illness, whether it be head and neck, lung, a cardiovascular problem, some, health issues, talking into a single camera, often in a dark room, saying how much regret they have, and this is your chance to learn from my bad behavior. That's the essential message. There's a lot of darkness, a lot of stigma, a lot of fear that's infused in this. So what you don't see is someone with their arm around that person as they tell their story saying, I support you. This has been hard. There's just no empathy in our messages or supportive in our messages that we could do a whole lot better job of infusing into these things as people tell their accurate story. I don't want to stop them from telling their stories because those are still powerful, but not in such a stark way that sends, in many ways, the wrong messages. And it's not that those messages aren't effective. They are. They do increase calls to quit lines and help people start that cessation process. But once again, what's the value? Relative value. How much harm does the society communicating that of fear and stigma and stupidity around smoking in those messages? What's the harm of that? And how do we balance that? What if we quit? Even if an empathic supportive messages had an effect of 8, whereas an aggressive tobacco control message has had an effect of 10, just making up numbers here.
Yeah.
But one message has a side effect of a negative 4, and the other one has no side effects. Who wins? In that kind of balanced equation, the empathic and supportive messages actually ends up being more effective in a relative sense, not in an absolute sense when you don't consider harms, but in a relative sense when you're balancing the benefits and harms, you may still come up ahead. We don't have that data yet for empathic and supportive approaches to messaging around that. But to me, it's worth a try.
So one of the things, just for the listeners who may not know all the details, I want to flesh out the CT screening. So CT screening eventually, had large randomized studies, the National Lung Screening Trial being one of them. And the idea that for people who had smoked more than a certain amount of cigarettes, measured by pack years, one pack a day for a certain number of years or variations on that, and being over a certain age, that they would get a low dose or spiral CT scan. And when you did this, you diagnosed the lung cancer, but you diagnosed it at an earlier stage before it had spread, and it was more amenable to curative therapy. And I think the number was about 300 people you had to screen in that high risk group to save one life. So pretty good bang for the buck.
Absolutely. Nice summary though, Ross.
Thanks very much. Well, I do this for a living, but thanks very much. But one thing is, okay, so when did that become available to the general community?
Okay, so the NLST was published in 2011, and it took until late 2013, which for us to have policy to support it. It was reviewed, and the key policymakers are the Preventive Services Task Force, as well as the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And really, it took effect, the favorable policies supporting this as a free service went into effect in 2015. So even once you announce a policy, there's a policy period for it to people to adapt to it. So really, 2015, January and February is the point that you can put on a map and say, or on a calendar and say, that's when evidence-based, policy-supported lung cancer screening was launched in the United States. Now, there were certainly lots of people doing it before then. There are some folks that were very convinced by the early observational single-arm trials and stage shift, but we don't make policy based on those studies. We make policy in screening based on randomized trials for the most part. And so those are available. So 2015 is the long-winded answer to your brief question.
Okay, so here we are, not quite at a decade, but the thing that amazes me is you have this evidence-based intervention. It saves lives. And then to put it into context, the number needed to screen to save one life is actually way lower than with many of the more established screening programs like mammography and colonoscopy and all those things. So it's really good. And yet, the national uptake amongst those who would meet those entry criteria, you know, based on smoking and age, was stunningly low. Can you flesh out those figures?
Yes. So the number of people who have participated in lung cancer screening is somewhere between 5 and 10% of the eligible community of individuals. That's atrocious. By comparative purposes, it's between 65 and 80% of individuals who are eligible for the three other evidence-based and policy-supported cancer screening modalities, which are mammography for breast cancer screening, any of the modalities for colorectal cancer screening, and cervical cancer screening. Between 65 and 80% on nationally in individuals who are eligible are actually up to date with the recommended screening guidelines. And yet for lung cancer, we're at somewhere between 5 and 10%. If you use self-report surveys, might say a little bit more, but the problem is that most of our society doesn't even know what a low-dose CT is or why you do it. And so there's some inflation of self-report. And then, when you actually look at claims data, it's very... nationally, it's just barely above 5%.
So this is, you know, a fantastic area for a health psychologist to get their teeth into. So when I see that data, the first question is are we not getting the message out to the people? Or although you might say you're getting a message out, but it's the wrong message. So are we not even attempting to communicate it, or are we just saying the wrong things?
It's both. That right now, lung cancer screening is the only evidence-based policy-supported cancer screening modality that lacks an allocation of resources from the federal government to the CDC to support national messaging campaign. We have dollars from our federal government that are distributed to the CDC for breast and cervical and colorectal to try to put this on the society's radar. We don't have that for lung yet, you know, and so that's obviously a policy initiative. CDC operates much more closely to federal funding. They only do what they can be told to do on a national basis. And so we need that funding to normalize lung cancer screening. The other aspect of it is the stigma that is pervasive around lung cancer does not generate the kind of empathy toward this community to be supportive of them pursuing cancer screening. If you doubt that, you can even look at any of our social media platforms for the healthcare community where information is exchanged. You put in a story about how lung cancer screening has been innovated. We changed the eligibility criteria or something. And in the comment section, you'll have clinicians say, I don't understand why we're wasting this money on people who won't quit smoking. Does everybody stigmatize individuals with a smoking history? No. But there are still prevalent beliefs in our healthcare system that this community of individuals does not deserve the intervention, the evidence-based intervention that we have to offer. But that's not how we do medicine. And yet those belief systems fail. So there's been a systematically suboptimal effort to integrate lung cancer screening into our healthcare system, both from, you know, a system level thing with regard to electronic health records, all the way down through training the clinicians to help them have the information and the skills and to actually implement this. And then you have a reluctant community of individuals who don't know that their lung cancer screening exists. So it takes a little bit more time to talk with them about it. You're explaining something new. And time is toxic to our healthcare system. We reinforce speed, not good. Yeah. And so there's just a whole host of a nightmare of combination of things. And because lung cancer screening is absolutely a needle in a haystack for primary care, and yet we put a lot of the responsibility of implementing lung cancer screening on primary care. And I think that was one of our first missteps, that it really needs to, the responsibility really needs to be placed more at the screening program level, because that's where revenue accrues. That's where effort and value returns to that community of individuals. And so we just have a lot of work to do to get lung cancer screening right. And we don't have time. The lung cancer advocacy community, one of the three principles things that they want to see in our work there is they want more hope infused into lung cancer. They want more empathy infused into lung cancer, and they want urgency.
Yeah.
There's no time to wait. We have these tools. And tools that you have in clinical care, we're seeing, dreadful numbers of individuals diagnosed that if you look at a claims database, that they get diagnosed with lung cancer and we can't see that they've ever received additional treatment, which is horrendous.
Yeah.
But it's partially based on the second thing. It's not just stigma, but it's this therapeutic nihilism that our system has. And sometimes it's clinicians, but sometimes it's the system that aren't familiar. And then finally, then the fatalism that we've taught. Our public understands two things about lung cancer. You get it because you smoked, and you die quickly and horribly. Those two societal beliefs do not conspire to help people run out and participate in this great new strategy that we have.
So mammography is not supported through primary care. It's a sort of standalone thing. Is that what you're saying? And that's your vision?
No, it's just what I'm saying is that they still often start the conversation, but it's a very easy, brief conversation because it's established social norm. Everybody that you know knows what a mammogram is and why you do it. But if you were asked your friends outside of your oncology world, what is a low-dose CT and why you do it, they haven't the faintest clue. And so there's just this lack of awareness or knowledge. And because it's a targeted strategy, it's not meant for everybody, it's harder. That means that instead of just knowing that someone's 50 or 45 or 40 or whatever, and you start that conversation, they have to be 50 and you have to know their PAC years. We have to ask you. You have to have what many people still consider to be an uncomfortable conversation about someone's smoking history. Yet, if we do it with empathically and inform people why we're asking about their smoking history, we can get much more accurate data that does not come off as stigmatizing or negative or problematic. And so it's just a bit more complicated. And we heaped all that responsibility on primary care as opposed to say, hey, oh, I think you're eligible for lung cancer screening. Why don't we have you schedule a follow-up for a consult visit with a shared decision-making with the lung cancer screening program team to see if it's right for you and they can help you through that process and navigate you with wherever you need to go. If it's come back in a year because you have a clear scan, or if we do find some nodules, we might need you to come back in 3 months or possibly 6 months, but we've got you. You're part of a system, you're part of a team, you're part of a program, and we're here to help. If you have any questions or concerns, we're here. You know who we are, and we'll help you through this process.
Well, that's a great segue into fleshing out how some of these ideas actually work. And so one of the key things, and you explained this to me once over coffee, is that rather disappointing national figure. There is state-by-state variation in terms of the uptake for screening. So when you started, who was the highest state? Who was the lowest state? Where was Kentucky?
So when we got started, theoretically in before 2013 or so, everybody should have been pretty low because it wasn't evidence-based. Although some of the folks quickly got out of the gate, or maybe even the sites that were participating in NLST recognized that and were already operating, so getting going. But it was, you know, still pretty low because no one really knew about it on a public health basis. So, but yet there were some states that just leapt out of the gate, if you will, and Massachusetts is one of those states, and they've always been the leader. They have a pretty good healthcare system in the state of covering everyone. They have lots of, you know, it's probably our medical state, if you will, you know, in terms of the incredible hospital systems that serve the entire state and things. So they've managed through a variety of really aggressive and state-based programs to receive, approach 20%. You know, that's still awful.
Yeah.
Let's face it. That's still awful.
It's the least worst, and he gets the old medal.
That's least terrible, I say.
Yeah.
At the time I was, my work was at the University of Kentucky College of Medicine and the Markey Cancer Center, and we were awarded a grant from the Bristol-Myers Squibb Foundation to work on a state-based initiative around lung cancer screening in Kentucky. Now, I probably just evoked visions of basketball, horses, bourbon, and smoking, in all likelihood, in people's minds. And that means, and that's associated with the fact that Kentucky continues to be the leader in lung cancer incidence on a state basis, as well as lung cancer mortality. And in reality, Ross, it wasn't close. The next states around us, you know, West Virginia and some in Mississippi and Arkansas, were not even nearly approaching at that time in 2014 when we launched the project. But the idea is that with this, what we call the Kentucky Leads Collaborative, and LEAD stood for Lung Cancer Education, Awareness, Detection, and Survivorship. But two of the three components of that were really focused on engaging primary care clinicians. And then the second one was on working with lung cancer screening programs to improve the quality of what they were doing, to better emulate the National Lung Screening Trial in community settings to realize those benefits. And throughout the process of about a 4 to 5 year implementation period where we were able to talk face-to-face with over 4,000 primary care clinicians and staff members at those things to try to get them the information, deliver the information to them, and talk with them about integrating lung cancer screening in part of their routine practices, and then work with lung cancer screening programs to optimize the quality and recognize that part of quality is doing community outreach and engagement, trying to deliver awareness and support awareness and engagement and opportunities to screen back to primary care, but also to the community. So a very much even longer story short, over the course of that project, we started to see some pretty favorable results. Kentucky moved up to being number two in implementation of lung cancer screening on a state level.
Where did it start?
Well, we started in the pack with everyone else at essentially zero, maybe 1 or 2%. But most states were at that 1 or 2% level, and so it was basically Massachusetts and everybody else at that time. But we steadily moved up and to achieved during the final year of the previous guidelines, we achieved almost 18% uptake of lung cancer screening at that time. This is before the pandemic, at that period of time. And it was, you know, we were number two at that time when Massachusetts was approaching 20% at that time. And so we were just a few percentage points behind. And this is Kentucky, a state that suffers tremendous socioeconomic challenges, does not have the same healthcare system or economic resources as Massachusetts. And so we were pretty excited about that. And I thought, my, I've just experienced the pinnacle of my career with taking a peek of that data. And then we interacted a little bit with our state cancer registry, who had run some analysis and reached out to us. We didn't even plan to do these analyses. They had reached out to us and said, hey, can you explain why late stage lung cancer diagnosis, which had been for decades bouncing between 78 and 82% of individuals diagnosed with late stage lung cancer in Kentucky. It's been decades, 78 to 82%, which is awful.
Of the people diagnosed with lung cancer, you know, the vast majority presenting with incurable disease.
Absolutely. Yep. You know, devastating diagnosis for families and for individuals and families. And, you know, in previous years, limited tools to address that as well. Now, of course, we have tools for every stage of disease and can extend life in many situations. As you well know, you've pioneered some of those treatments. But we saw a 10% decline in between 2015, when we started implementing our project, and 2018. A 10% decline in just those few years of implementing lung cancer screening and taking a state-based approach that accelerated that change. And we've seen that we now have data from the early 2000s. We've seen that continue to decline. And for the first time in recorded oncology data history, lung cancer mortality among men in Kentucky dip below two other states.
Wow.
And so we are on a trajectory because Kentucky has always been known in oncology circles as, you know, an epicenter of lung cancer mortality in the entire world. It's now becoming known for the state with the most change. We're nowhere near where we want to be or could be, but we've seen our deceleration of lung cancer mortality is beyond fathom from when we started. And it's still only reaching less than, 15% now of those individuals who are eligible. And if we could get that, if we could help move that needle by creating a better environment for these individuals, more compassion, more empathy, infusing more hope in our tobacco control messages, giving them a reason to believe that lung cancer screening could be of value to them, we could see this further decelerate in terms of the number of families in Kentucky and across the country that face a lung cancer death. And there's just so much potential with this tool, but we've made so many missteps in our implementation, and I'm very excited to say that the NCI has recognized this implementation challenge and will be funding 3 new grants to address implementation of lung cancer screening to help disseminate lung cancer screening more effectively across our country so that we can continue to decelerate lung cancer mortality, you know, and maybe even a little bit of lung cancer incidents, because when we combine evidence-based tobacco treatment into our lung cancer screening platforms, and when we do that effectively, we actually reduce the likelihood that someone ever develops lung cancer. And that, and so this is just a wonderful platform. And now I'm going to speak to the choir a little bit, because we have so many new treatments for metastatic disease, local disease. We have better surgeries, better radiation approaches, target therapies, immunotherapies that we have to offer. There's a reason for hope. There's a reason to have hope infused in all of our messages around lung cancer, and yet we're not seeing that. And we need that transformative cultural change in how we view lung cancer to be able to deliver these innovations to the community that would benefit. And that's all just well and warm and good feeling, but economically we would benefit this from our society as well, because of the expense of treating late stage lung cancer.
I mean, if you just think about it, I almost get chills just thinking about it, just how many, probably thousands of lives that approach, which you've been part of, has has saved. And, you know, to go back to your analogy of sports psychology, this is the visualization and you're kind of like a quarter of the way through the race. And it's like, okay, keep going. You've done that personal best on that first quarter.
Yeah, because Kentucky's just the start of it. And there's some unique things. I think we actually benefited by starting in Kentucky with our project because of the frustration of primary care clinicians. And there's not a primary care clinician in Kentucky that hasn't been practicing for over a year that hasn't had seen someone diagnosed with lung cancer. I mean, in some ways, during that or those early years and before them, lung cancer was one of the ways Kentuckians died. And it was a socially acceptable kind of thing because there wasn't anything we could do about it. And so there was frustrations in primary care. So I think that one of the reasons it works so well and sort of scares me about our new projects going out to other states other than Kentucky, there was salience in Kentucky.
Salience?
Salience. There was no, you couldn't talk to a primary care clinician and they give you the Heisman because they don't deal with lung cancer. You know, there's no, they're like, really? You know, that's interesting. You know, they had people that they immediately thought of in their panel of patients that could benefit from it. So there was an excitement that they had something new to offer, that they didn't just have to badger them about smoking anymore. They could add a layer of, hey, there's a screening for you. So there was an excitement, or the burden of lung cancer was so high in Kentucky that there was a perceived opportunity, and we just kind of got lucky and it was at the right time where we were adding something to the equation. As we extend our research efforts into new states and now in Mississippi and Nevada, that don't suffer the same absolute burden. You know, relatively, they still have high levels of lung cancer incidence and mortality, but not at the devastating level of Kentucky at that time. Will we have that salience? Because I'll be honest, we've tried to do some of the things in Colorado, and we've talked to rural primary care, and it says, you know, I haven't seen somebody with lung cancer in 5 years. Why would I start screening all my folks?
Yeah.
And so, well, in reality, it's evidence-based policy supported, and it could help people. And, you know, maybe you've missed a few, you know, in your time. That's not how we say it. We're much more empathic and understanding and say, yeah, that does sound like a, you know, maybe a not, but we know that there are measures coming, quality measures coming that will, you know, more or less force their hand to integrate it into primary care. And we're here to help before the pressure is on.
You know, when we sit down and had coffee and just talked through your achievements and the idea, amazingly enough, you know, within the career of one scientist, you know, being able to take this idea, implement it, and showing it mattered, you know, where do you go from here professionally? And then also, we didn't talk about it at all, but, you know, you're a guy who's married and has got two daughters, you know, do they get to see dad? And what are they, do they respect you for what you've done? Or are you just like my daughters, you're kind of like, whatevs?
those are good questions. I'll start with the next steps, and that is taking our state-based initiative to new states and see if it'll work, and working hard to secure grant funding to do that. And we've been fortunate to continue our relationship with the Bristol Myers Squibb Foundation, who've been amazing supporters of our work for over a decade now, and we will be extending it to Mississippi and Nevada. And we also are competing for additional funding from the National Cancer Institute, and we won't find out for a few months. And so there's still a lot of enthusiasm in this vein of research to try to bring it to more places and adapt it and try to create that lung cancer screening nirvana, if you will, where it's normative. Lung cancer screening, our goal in many ways is for lung cancer screening just to be another cancer screening that people consider doing if they're eligible, that we've eradicated the stigma, that we've eradicated the nihilism, that we've eradicated the complexities for primary care and help support them and help them integrate it in the way that they they start the discussion about colorectal, they start this discussion about breast cancer screening, and it's just part of what they do. And so embracing it and helping that happen more readily. And so it does take a lot of money to do these kind of multi-level state-based initiatives where you're talking with society, you're talking with clinicians and healthcare systems, and you're talking with the eligible community. That's really three different intervention studies packaged into one. But one without the other two can only get you so far. Because you have to have a social norm where people feels like it's available, clinicians that are referring to it, and candidates who are receptive to the idea. And in, you know, any one of those that's not part of the equation is going to dampen the potential. But together, maybe there's some interactive effects where that's more, you know, asymptotic in terms of its benefit. Second question was, I think my kids love me. I'm not sure on a day-to-day basis, but I do get to see them a fair amount. But it has been challenging. You know, when the career, am I fortunate for my career that other people are interested in what we've done and do a fair number of, you know, 10 to 20 talks a year and on the road quite a bit. But technology helps us stay connected. And, you know, my kids are now teenagers, so they're less interested in time with me and more interested of sending money. It's worked out. But I will say that I have a balance issue that must be addressed in the coming years and figuring out how to keep things that I'm passionate about in work aligned with the passion I have for being a good dad and a good husband and a good community member and things like that. And that's a work in progress that I don't always feel very good about, to be honest.
I think it's always a work in progress. Jamie, thank you so much for sharing your passion for this. And as I say, I hope your girls realize how many lives you've saved. Maybe in years to come, they'll look back and go, you know, my dad was a superhero, but I think you are.
Bex. Thank you, sir. Appreciate that kindness.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with me, Ross Kamage. Rate us and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or follow us at DR Kamage on X for additional commentary.